Hello, this is Orson Welles speaking. Last week I missed the broadcast. It pleases me to imagine that you didn't miss the broadcast and that you missed me. If so, may I interest you, please, in my assurances that I'm all well again and that all's well with the Mercury again. The Mercury Theater's new musical Around the World, which has been playing such havoc with my health, is in better shape than I am, ladies and gentlemen. And another week, we move to Broadway. Just now we're in Philadelphia and doing very nicely, thank you, as to business. And this cheers us up quite some because another big, elaborate Mercury production got into this city on another spring, never went on to New York at all. Five Kings, that was, and plenty of years ago that was, too. Five Kings was mostly an omnibus Henry IV, parts 1 and 2 by Mr. Shakespeare and his Henry V. Well, as you know, Mr. Laurence Olivier's movie, Henry V, is the movie news of the month, and his Henry IV, by the Old Vic Producing Company, playing in New York, is the theater news of the week, maybe of the year. I don't know. I haven't seen it, but I hope to before Ralph Richardson, who's Falstaff, and the rest of those fine actors go back to England, before I have to pack my bags and start west for a summer in Hollywood. Well, aren't I the chatty one this morning? Last week this time I wasn't so blithe, believe me. Motoring down from New Haven, I checked in at the Algonquin, a hotel which, as far as I was concerned last week, turned out to be just on the corner of 44th Street and a nervous breakdown. I just squeaked around that corner by the artful dodge of not going to work and passed a fretful 48 hours between the sheets thinking about this show and the other one, the stage show, and the... Both of them, of course, weren't going on. Excuse me while I find my place. Really, I don't know why the show must go on. We always say the show must go on, you know. Nobody ever misses any show except the people who put it on. That's what I told myself last weekend, that lost last weekend. But believe me, it was cold comfort in a darkened hotel room. The last time I stopped at the Algonquin was that black time when that other earlier show of ours opened in Philadelphia and was getting ready to close there, and I'd come to New York for another broadcast and come down with a high fever, and this fairly scarifying coincidence contributed no little to my gloomy Sunday 7 days ago. The brightening picture for Around the World, therefore, is what makes me sound so little like your political commentator and so much like somebody's idiot son writing a letter home. The Algonquin, since we're launched on this spurt of reminiscence and chit-chat, is a fine hotel as well as a famous one. Books are written in it and about it. This mostly, I suppose, because Frank Case, who owns the institution, makes such a good job of running it. And also perhaps because Frank reads a little himself and writes quite a lot. Of course, the celebrated Round Table is no more. Heywood Broun and Alec Wolcott are no longer with us. But folks who do things worth mentioning and say things worth repeating still make a habit of lunch at Mr. Casey's Tavern, and I'm happy to report that the popovers are as buoyant and gorgeous as of yore. I can't leave off talking about the Algonquin without telling you one of my favorite Algonquin stories. It concerns another of the Algonquin stalwarts, another one who's checked out for good, along with Jack Barrymore and Alec and Heywood. I mean, Robert Benchley. Bob used to come in for six-day weekends on 44th Street. This was a custom of years standing, and it was noted by the hotel staff through the years that his luggage was invariably heavier on departure than upon arrival. With a hotel man's philosophic tolerance of petty larceny, nothing was said regarding this. And then it came to pass that after much urging, Frank Case consented to be Benchley's house guest for a night or two in those outer suburbs where the Benchley family kept official residence. Bob showed his hotel proprietor, house guest and friend, proudly to the guest room and, to a practical joke of very long preparation, not only the linen, the towels and blankets, the occasional oddments like ashtrays, but also the rugs, the curtains, and even small articles of furniture were all plainly marked Hotel Algonquin. Well, it's been too long now since we've read letters from any of you, and I've been getting a lot of them, and they've been wonderful. As you know, we have a custom of reading your letters and a custom of thanking you for the letters we use by sending you a radio, a very fine table model. This week's letter, if I only get to one, gets a radio for a lady who wants to be anonymous and who writes me as follows. Dear Mr. Welles, one very ordinary day in March 1946, something happened which made it not an ordinary day at all. A group of men formed a little parade of themselves. Tall, strong, determined men they were, yet men in whose eyes could be detected fear. And so, most truthfully, they could be called brave men also. Uniforms bearing the label USA and a little discharge button were the predominant costumes. The others were suits, unmatched trousers and coats and sweaters, but that doesn't matter. Two abreast, they came along through the streets, often calling out to others to join them, and when such efforts were crowned with success and their numbers were swelled, their rigid faces would relax for a moment and their step become lighter. They might even be able to swallow past the tightness in their throats. On they went. People stopped and stared. Groups clustered together. There were expressions of horror, and the view with alarmists began to view most energetically. Likewise, may I most thankfully say, there were those, though apparently much too few in number, whose hearts were filled with pride and whose eyes were filled with tears as they watched that march that exacted a courage equal to that of the valiant 600. Equal, did I say? I beg your pardon. 1,000 pardons, my brave marchers. You knew the reason why, but you did not know what might be the aftermath of that march. Lynchings, jail, mob terror, all were exceedingly possible, yet on they went. Their pilgrimage ended at a huge building over whose entrance is inscribed a touching sentiment having to do with justice to one and all. Police officers appeared and arrested some of these marchers. The charge was using the uniform for political purposes, the uniform being of the USA, the home of the brave. It's supposed to be used only to depart this life. Nevertheless, the others made their way to the office of the registrar. The spokesman inquired if they might register as duly qualified voters of the state of Alabama, USA, the land of the free and the home of the brave. They were duly informed that the office was closing. They'd have to return the following day. And so, with depleted ranks and a sense of anticlimax, they did return. And yesterday, a radio announcer informed any who might be listening that for the first time in 70 years, the Democratic primaries of the state of Alabama, USA, the land of the free, etc., was open to Negro citizens of the aforementioned USA. Hail to you, O marchers. To the lady who wrote this letter, which I appreciate having been able to read to you, may I say just this, madam, I respect your desire for anonymity. By the way, she writes me this as a postscript note to Mr. Wells. Please do not reveal my name in connection with this writing, as I do not wish to lose a friend. May I respect your desire for anonymity, madam, but may I also regret it. Secrecy, I think, is a matter for the ballot box, but not for convictions as wholesome as yours. Secrecy, for example, is a special attribute of the Ku Klux Klan, a group of marchers quite different than those you speak of in your letter. Refer you to recent newspapers. I'm sure you see what I mean. Last night, madam, a man in Alabama put his head into a hood. He wrapped himself in a sheet. Then he went and stood on a hill outside of town with a number of his friends and neighbors, all of them with their heads hooded and all of them wrapped in sheets. I don't know exactly what they did up there on the hill. There were some speeches, probably, and maybe some community singing. I don't know how you sing in a hood. And at the climax of the evening's entertainment, there was the burning of a fiery cross. I remember when I was a little boy, I saw one of those crosses raising a glow in the sky, and I remember wishing I could join the fun, thinking that fiery cross was some kind of kid's prank. Somebody explained that the Ku Klux Klan was burning its cross in the field in favor of a thing called white supremacy, and I remember thinking it must be some kind of practical joke. I've since discovered that the notion of white supremacy isn't any sort of joke, and I found out that wherever it's been tried, it certainly hasn't been practical. But the fiery cross looked like lots of fun, and I imagined that this white supremacy thing must be an institution comparable to Halloween. When I saw the hoods and sheets the Ku Kluxers wore, I was sure I was right. Now that I'm a man and the Klan is riding again, I've had some time to think about it, and I'm not sure I was wrong. Now, I'm not suggesting that the gentlemen of the KKK are just a lot of grown-up boys. They aren't burning those crosses to roast marshmallows. I'm just recalling what I felt like in the days when I put my head into a hood. Of course, it was a pillowcase with two holes in it, but the effect's about the same as the man's in Alabama. Well, the purpose was different. I wasn't old enough to vote or old enough to stop somebody else from voting. But there crowds back into recollection the restless mood of frenzy that went with the hood, with the wearing of the sheet. I remember that when we kids were Halloween ghosts, we always kept together, ringing doorbells and dumping out garbage. We worked as a gang. Of course, we wanted our victims to think us the most fearsome hobgoblins. But when one of us found himself alone for even a minute, He was seized with a kind of panic. He was more scared than anybody tried to scare. And there is, I think, a timeless truth in this. One of the most awful experiences in the whole range of terror is to be a lonesome, a solitary spook. Such a spook is like the purple cowl. It is better to see than be one. The Ku Kluxer, then, cut off from the company of the hooded herd, might very well take sudden leave of what senses still remain to him, and there may well have been cases where a prominent local lawyer or a respected member of the business community has been found on some gray dawn somewhere in the suburbs, dancing on the embers of a cross, squeaking and gibbering in his sheet. It is, I think, a terrible thought. Like most thoughts concerning masks worn in the dark, it is almost too terrible for any thought. In the days when I wore a hood, I remember a fleeting fear that I was not so much protected from recognition by the law-abiding world as cut off by my very facelessness from the comforts of that world. Soaping the window was a gay occupation, but I remember also the intensity of that feeling of being outside looking in. And if the grown-up citizens in sheets who burnt the cross in Alabama last night are worth our study, and they are, I think the embryo emotions of Halloween are helpful references. I deduce that the man in a hood last night burning his cross and muttering his muffled oaths knew that outside feeling, the dark sense of standing in that featureless congregation utterly alone, outside of every righteous human law. On the wrong side of all the windows in the world. Of course, there was in Alabama last night the reassurance of ritual on that hill. There was such ritual in the secret societies convened in our ancestral caves. Jungle rituals, voodoo, mumbo-jumbo, black magic. It's no accident that the headman of the clan, the ruling Ku Kluxer, is called a wizard, and it is more than a casual matter that the central ceremonial of the KKK is the burning of the cross. This is a very old instinct indeed. The urge to blasphemy, that most antique, most antic sin, as old as sin itself, as old as any church, the profanation of the altar. The mad pagan Nazis crippled the cross and made it the trademark of their party. The hooded man in Alabama and his friends in the hooded herd set fire to the cross. And because men cannot escape the veracities of the symbols they choose, these men announced to the Alabama night their intention. And this is to burn up the teachings and examples of him whose anguish has made the cross a sign for the very passions of brotherhood. We've been concerned today with what goes on in the brain, in the head, in the hood. This is, to be sure, a very trifling concern indeed. What matters is what's going on in the heart of this nation when the KKK rides again and the cross is burned at night in the hills above our sleeping towns. When I wore a hood, I was afraid to wear the hood alone. I think the same thing goes for the man in Alabama who wore the hood last night and for his sheeted colleagues, wherever they are meeting in this land of the free. The way to fight these Ku Kluxers is not to unmask them. That's too easy. The trick is to separate them one from the other because they run in packs. Since they're so interested in segregation, let's segregate them. All right, I see my time's about up. Again, my thanks to the lady for her letter and my thanks to you for listening. Goodbye. Please let me come to call again this same time next week. Till then, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.